Painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
During the span of 1912 through 1913, a most interesting individual captured the attention of the entire town of Winona, Minnesota. Rockwell Kent. In honor of this Renaissance man, Winona, Minnesota had Rockwell Kent in Winona, a centennial celebration which took place this February 6th through the 10th. Many activities took place, including a symposium. Today we feature a talk by Beth Christensen on the connection between Rockwell Kent and Carl Ruggles. Carl Ruggles was a composer and a conductor. Today we'll find out how Rockwell Kent and Carl Ruggles crossed paths and how they influenced each other's works. We now take you to part one of the Rockwell Kent Symposium with a foreword by Taft Roberts, introducing us to the man known as Rockwell Kent. You're listening to Artbeat.
Well, welcome to Winona State University. I'm Andrew Higgle from the English department here at Winona State. And welcome to the Rockwell Kent Symposium. And I'm just going to let you know that the Rockwell Kent Symposium today is sponsored by the Celebration of the Book. This is our Celebration of the Book event for this year, and that's out of the English department here at Winona State. And it's co-sponsored with the Minnesota Marine Art Museum through the Ernest and Sally Mysek family in memory of W.B. Gouch. And I'm here to introduce our moderator today and the event coordinator, Taft Roberts.
Thank you very much for being here. This has been a dream of mine. 20 years ago, we came up with the idea of potentially having a Rockwell Kent show at the public library in Winona, where Kent actually had his first show in 1913, thanks to Mr. Prentice. I'm in the unenviable position of trying to describe who Rockwell Kent was in 5 minutes. If any of you know me, you know that's going to be a challenge. And the only way that I can do that is I have some written notes here because I want to go through them and let you know some things that some of the presenters that are going to come here this afternoon might not mention. But I just want to give you a kind of a picture of who this guy was. Rockwell Kent was a painter, a printmaker, illustrator, writer, architect, explorer, farmer, politician, unfaithful husband, an overflowing artist of amazing energy and talent who once said, "Do you want my life in a nutshell? It's this, that I have only one life and I'm going to live it as nearly possible as I want to live it." He certainly did that in a big way. Rockwell Kent was born in Tarrytown, New York, in 1882, into an upper class Victorian family. He lost his father to typhoid at the early age of 5. Rosa, the Austrian maid, taught Rockwell German before he spoke English. He was a very difficult child and very hard to control. That stayed with him his whole life. In 1902, he studied architecture at Columbia University and also took summer painting classes with William Merritt Chase. He lived and worked alongside Abbot Thayer, who introduced him to the Icelandic sagas, studied with Robert Henri, who introduced him to the writings of Tolstoy and the powerful forces of the natural world. Kent arrived on Monhegan Island off the coast of Maine in 1905 and was mesmerized by the fishing community and their families and how they interacted and helped each other out. He arrived here in Winona in 1912 to supervise the construction of 2 Georgian mansions for the Prentice and Bell families called Briarcone Farms. Kent was instrumental in creating the first workers' strike in the history of our state, Minnesota. After his time in Winona, he returned to New York and sailed on a freighter with his family to Newfoundland, where he was deported the following year. In 1929, he actually sailed to Greenland with 2 friends on Direction, a sturdy, double-ended, 33-foot wooden sailboat. Kent was appointed the navigator, and they sailed out of Batik, Nova Scotia. They crossed the dangerous Davis Straits, and the direction was wrecked while under anchor in a fjord on the rugged western coast of Greenland. And if you ever want to read the book, North by East, N by E, that's a wonderful story of that voyage. In Greenland, he very much enjoyed the social connections in the small communities and how everyone had a part to play and how they all came together to get the daily work accomplished. Kent was a vegetarian and a pacifist and was very encouraged when he found out that when the two males in Greenland, when they experienced a conflict, they were to meet at the town hall in front of the inhabitants of the village. They would sing for hours, each one in turn, and the one which was greeted with the most applause. In 1929, returning from Greenland, he met the great vagrant Viking explorer Peter Frücken, and they became immediate friends when they arrived in Denmark. Kent and Francis moved in to Frücken's family home and started his pen and ink illustrations for Herman Melville's Moby Dick. In 1953, Kent appeared before the Un-American Committee headed by the Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy. His passport was taken away for 7 years, and he was unable to travel during that time. In 1957-58, he donated hundreds of paintings, drawings, and books to the Soviet people. In 1967, Kent was awarded the Lenin Peace Prize. Kent died in March of 1971. 3 months short of his 89th birthday. His final resting place close to his studio cabin has over a slab of gray marble. And on the marble is Kent's name, his dates, a bird, an olive branch, and the words, "This is my own." I'd like to introduce you now to our first presenter. Beth Christensen is a music librarian at St. Olaf's College, a position she has held for more than 30 years. She holds a graduate degrees in both musicology with a minor in art history and library and information science, and has published in both fields. Beth studied with Sydney Simon and Carol Ann Marling at the University of Minnesota and is married to a painter and professor of art. Beth's research interest in music is focused on American music in the early 20th century, particularly Carl Ruggles and his circle of friends that included Rockwell Kent. She had published a thesis about Ruggles and Kent's relationship, which he began when they met here in Winona in 1913 at the Winona Public Library. Beth has always had a fascination with the way visual artists and musicians can inspire one another and work together. Beth's master's thesis in musicology was a documentary study of the ballet Pulcinella, for which Stravinsky collaborated with Picasso, who designed the sets. For the past 10 years, Beth has been studying Carl Ruggles' correspondence and is in the process of transcribing and editing the documents. Please give Beth a big, warm Minnesota welcome.
Thank you, Tap. I can't tell you what a treat it is to finally meet the man who's been sending me emails with subject lines like, "Whales ahoy." So it's a real treat to meet you and to see all of you in Winona. I feel as if I'm coming to this talk a bit through the side door because I'm entering through the portal of Carl Ruggles rather than Rockwell Kent. But the more I know about Rockwell Kent, the more I think he'd probably kind of like that. So here I am. That two hard-headed, unconventional artists from the East Coast, one a composer and conductor, the other an architect, painter, and draftsman, happened to be in Winona, Minnesota in 1912 and 13 is surprising enough. That they met one another on a June afternoon in the Winona Public Library and felt an immediate spark of inspiration and friendship that would last a lifetime is even more improbable. Yet this chance meeting, under unexpected circumstances, would foster fundamental choices that would shape the lives and influence the art of Rockwell Kent and Carl Ruggles forever. First, I'd like to take a quick digression or diversion to set the stage of what Winona was like for Kent and Ruggles in 1912. Winona's history, as many of you probably know, dates back to 1851, when a steamboat captain from Galena, Illinois, deposited three men on a sandbar and told them to claim the land, land that was later to be known as Winona. It was a strategic location since it served as a point of assembly for the harvested lumber that was floated down the St. Croix, the Chippewa, and the Mississippi rivers. According to historian Henry Castle, quote, "Everything was of wood, and nearly every stick had to be imported. It's difficult to imagine the amount of wood necessary to settle and develop the Midwest, but not hard at all to see why Mississippi River towns thrived with the growth of the Midwestern plain." Winona quickly grew into one of the largest and most prosperous cities in Minnesota, which is all sort of relative, but from a population of 2,400 in 1860, a year when only 11 towns in Minnesota had more than 100 people, Winona grew to almost 20,000 inhabitants by 1900. By 1910, the population had established itself at a relatively steady 18,583 people. It was the fourth largest city in Minnesota, behind Minneapolis with over 301,000, St. Paul with 214,000, and Duluth with slightly over 76,000. By comparison, New York and Chicago had 4 and 2 million people. In order to support the lumber trade, massive immigrations of laborers came to Winona to work for meager wages. In 1900, the county employed more than 1,500 skilled and common laborers, compared to just 79 professional men and 106 capitalist and retired people. And I think I would have liked to have been one of those 106. The two largest immigrant groups were Germans and Poles. Germans comprised 29% of the population and Poles 11%. While the owners of the lumber companies were quickly becoming millionaires, the wages of the laborers remained very low. A worker in the sawmills could put in 11 hours a day, 6 days a week, and earn just $1.50 a day. This caused an economic and cultural divide that would have an impact on both Kent and Ruggles. Although Winona was relatively small in comparison to Chicago and New York, it boasted a number of important economic and cultural developments. The Winona Normal School opened in 1860, and it was the first teacher's college west of the Mississippi. Winona had a telephone exchange in 1880, just 4 years after Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. And by 1889, Winona had an opera house, which was managed by O.F. Burlingame. The Winona Daily News later reported, quote, "From the moment that O.F. Burlingame stepped within the wide double doors beneath the marquee of the Winona Opera House, the Chicago-Minneapolis circuit was broken, and Winona's stop became a must with the shining lights of the theater world." Sarah Bernhardt came in 1910, John Philip Sousa in 1911, Ernestine Schumann Heink in 1914, Lillian and Dorothy Gish, Ethel Barrymore, Lillian Russell also appeared. This was the atmosphere into which Kent and Ruggles came. Interestingly, both Ruggles and Kent's ancestors immigrated from England to Massachusetts within about a decade of one another in the 1630s, both sides of Rockwell Kent's and Ruggles' family. And they were in close proximity in the Boston area. The Ruggles and the Rockwell families were within 2 miles of each other in the 1630s. Charles Ruggles, who later called himself Carl because he liked Germans so much, was born in 1876, and he grew up in Marion, Massachusetts, which is just west of Cape Cod. And as we've already heard, Rockwell Kent, born 6 years later, grew up 203 miles away in Tarrytown, New York. That both men journeyed over 1,300 miles to Winona, Minnesota for work, and that they briefly met one another would prove unlikely and providential. Ruggles began his musical career at the ripe age of 6, by playing a violin he'd made out of a cigar box. His family moved closer to Boston when he was about 13, and he was able to get more formal training in music, not only the violin, but also composition and counterpoint. Ruggles studied privately with, among other important musical teachers, John Knowles Payne, who worked part-time at Harvard, and Ruggles liked to tell people that he had gone to Harvard. He spent his evenings soaking up the music of the Boston Symphony. His was a fully American brand of music education, in contrast to so many of his contemporaries who went to Europe to study composition and music. Aaron Copland, for example, famously studied with Nadia Boulanger in Paris. Kent also began his interest in art at a young age, stating, "From as early as I can remember, I drew pictures." He enrolled at Columbia University in 1900 to study architecture, but spent his summers studying painting and drawing at the seasonal program established by William Chase. It wasn't long before he was lured away from architecture to study with Robert Henri at the New York School of Art, or Chase School. Henri, as Taff has already mentioned, had an enormous impact on Kent, an impact that went well beyond art. He introduced Kent to the writings of Darwin and Tolstoy, to summers on Monhegan Island, and to the enormous economic disparity in New York and beyond. The seeds of socialism had been sown. Kent learned skills as a carpenter and soon built his own home on Monhegan. He also painted and drew at every chance he got, and in 1911 was part of a group show of 15 artists that also included George Lux, John Mirren, Guy Pendebois, Maurice Prendergast, Arthur Davies, and Marsden Hartley. It was a combination of drafting and carpentry ability, however, and not his work as an artist, that brought Kent to Winona in 1912. He'd been hired to supervise the building of two large homes joined by a walkway for Mr. Prentice and Mr. Bell, whose wives were sisters. Ruggles was already in Winona at the time, having come here 5 years earlier in January of 1907, to teach at the Martimar School of Music. He was connected to the school through friends of his fiancée, Charlotte Snell. It's interesting to read the letters that Carl and Charlotte wrote to each other during those first few months when Carl was here and Charlotte still out east. Carl described the local flavors in every respect, and one of my favorite letters is one that he wrote on January 13th, in which he enclosed a piece of cheese, and the grease stain on the envelope will attest to the fact that he did send her cheese through the mail. He described it rather enthusiastically as, quote, "a fragment of cheese that will, if given time, banish most anything. But it's great, dearie, a product of the West. I don't remember having eaten anything like it before." Charlotte joined Carl in April of 1907 and was installed as the head of the vocal department at the Martimar School. The two musicians spent the summer of 1907 back east, and when they returned to Winona in the fall, they found that their jobs had been eliminated. With the eventual demise of the Martimar School remaining a mystery, newspaper accounts published that autumn stated that the violin and vocal departments had been dropped because they weren't profitable. The two nonetheless decided to stay in Winona. Charlotte became involved in a variety of church and community organizations, and she developed a large private vocal studio. In October, Carl was asked to conduct the YMCA orchestra for $14 a month. And in late January, the Musical Literary Society approached him about establishing an orchestra. The Winona Symphony Orchestra was born. The two musicians married in April, and together they fostered a growing enthusiasm for music in the community. During the 1912 music season, the year in which Rockwell Kent came, the Winona Opera House, which seated 1,200 people, was sold out for each and every performance the orchestra gave. And I tried to calculate it, that was almost 7% of this population, which would have a difficult time affording to go there. Arriving in spring of that year, it would have been possible for Kent to have heard Ruggles' orchestra, but he didn't. Rather than be welcomed into the community by Winona's wealthiest society of lawyers and merchants, Kent clearly felt like a paid employee of the Prentices and the Bells. He, his wife Kathleen, and their two young children settled into an abandoned schoolhouse near the construction site, and Rockwell fixed it up enough to be inhabitable. He was infinitely more at ease with the construction workers than with the management, and he reveled in speaking German every chance he could get. When the carpenters threatened to go on strike, Kent was questioned about his dual position because he was acting as both supervisor and carpenter on the job. He later recounted that they should ask me, considering my dual position on the job was not to be wondered at. Yet my position was quite simple. As superintendent, it was my duty to see that the buildings were erected in accordance with the specifications and the terms of the contract. As a member of the union, the International Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, I was technically and morally bound to support the men, my brothers. And I told them, good. The building project proceeded relatively smoothly with Kent working in this dual role. When Kathleen became pregnant in the spring of 1913, the Kents decided that, quote, not having gotten to like Winona well enough to stay, Kathleen would return east and wait for Rockwell to join her when he had finished the job. Kent remembered the remaining months in Winona as his best, and his correspondence with Kathleen provides an intriguing glimpse into his life and activities at that time. Among other things, he developed a close friendship with the German Alex Geckler and his family. In addition to his hard work at the building site, Kent organized two events during his last weeks in Minnesota. With Samuel Prentice's help, he planned an exhibition of paintings at the Winona Public Library during the first week of June. He also organized a grand picnic for the site workers, which was titled the Grand International Working Man's Anti-Boss Convention, and was a big success. Kent wrote to Kathleen with at least as much enthusiasm about the picnic as he did about his upcoming art exhibit. He said, "Darling Kathleen, it's the morning before our great day. Last night I worked very late, so late that I simply couldn't get to bed. We made a beautiful poster that we're going to hang up out there today. It's headed Grand International Workingmen's Anti-Boss Convention." And here is a sample of the poster. And under it, you can't make out from the photograph, but all of the events are listed, which include an amazing variety of races. There's a fat men's race, a lean men's race, a middle-sized men's race, and a dizzy man's race. And I also found it interesting that the music was provided by Olson's Oriental Orchestra. And everyone's family was invited to the picnic. One can easily glimpse why Kent's presence would have been a bit disconcerting to his bosses. Of the art exhibit at the Winona Public Library, Kent later described the show this way, quote, "All of the almost countless pictures I had painted were with me in Winona. So the exhibition that I staged in the library could well be, as it was, a fairly large one, and I may say without affecting modesty, a good one." There's no list of exactly what was exhibited, but a newspaper account mentioned Toilers of the Sea as one of the works displayed. Rockwell sent Kathleen progress reports about his plans for the show throughout the month of May, and from them we know that he was disappointed with the library's lighting, which he deemed very dark and full of shadows, as well as his inability to fit all of his paintings into the space. Despite these shortcomings, Kent thought the show looked, quote, pretty well, and he was disappointed that Winona didn't agree more enthusiastically. Although he was the subject of a large article in the newspaper, Kent remembered that Winona's, quote, just thought the show funny. And he credited Carl Ruggles, whom he met for the first time at the exhibition, with offering, quote, the only heartening words about my work that I received from anyone. Here's how he later described Ruggles at that first meeting. A strange, intense little man, a bald, egg-headed little man with eyes that were a light of fervor and a protruding lower lip that could betoken such conceit and arrogance as might defy the world or tremble with emotion close to tears. He was alone in the rotunda of the library when I entered. He walked straight over to me and reached out his hand. "You," he said, "are a great painter." For those words of recognition, there in the cultural no man's land of Winona, I have been ever grateful. This little man, this man so strange as to have thought me great, was a struggling music teacher and conductor of the Winona Symphony. He was the Carl Ruggles so widely known in the world of music today. Kent and Ruggles felt an immediate rapport, and I think they look like they could have been brothers. And Carl and Charlotte invited Rockwell to dinner before the artists left for the East in mid-June. Rockwell wrote to Kathleen that he found the Ruggles to be, quote, first-rate people and genuine musicians. Ruggles makes no pretense as a performer, but is a serious composer. He played many parts of his opera, and they were splendid. The text is The Sunken Bell by Hauptmann. That must be a wonderful process. He played much from Tristan, but gave it the volume of an orchestra, and they so detest Minnesota. Phew, you never heard such an outpouring. This chance meeting and the subsequent dinner fostered an enduring relationship between the two men. They saw each other the following September in New York City, where Kent, having resumed his work with the architectural firm, was living. They spent an evening together, Kent recalling staying there till late. And the next day, Ruggles introduced Kent to the artist Boardman Robinson. Carl and Charlotte returned to Winona that autumn with the hope of owning one of Kent's paintings. Ruggles wrote to Kent in October and November referring to the artist's seascapes and declaring that he was, quote, hungry for a sight of the sea. He poignantly signed his letters, "Yours in Exile." Ruggles also wrote about his progress on the opera, and he encouraged Kent to see the artwork of Arthur Davies. Thus began an important pattern in their correspondence. Each man was interested in and encouraged the other's art form. Just before Christmas of 1913, Carl and Charlotte received Kent's painting, The Saners, a work that Ruggles may very well have seen in the Winona Public Library. Ruggles sent Kent an enthusiastic letter that described his work on The Sunken Bell. He even included some musical motives, and he declared that people in New York thought it, quote, very advanced. And he also sent his reaction to Kent's art. "My dear Rockwell, The Saners came Wednesday, and the magic of it has held us enthralled ever since. It is a glory. Every time we look at it, we discover something new to marvel at. Robinson thought it one of the finest marines he had ever seen. I see many new touches. In fact, the whole picture has taken on a heightened eloquence. What I admire so intensely about all your work is its absolute freedom from conventions. You certainly sail uncharted seas. To hell with those who piddle around the creeks, I say. The word freedom, I think, expresses the basic quality of your work. I feel it surging through everything I have seen." And here he also included, as he almost always did in his correspondence, some of his musical motives for his opera. And he apologized at the bottom. He said, "I'll send you some that are better copied in a few days." Carl wrote again in January, telling Kent about how well the progress of the opera was being received in New York, and again complimenting Kent on the mystery in the foreground of his painting. "Indeed, there can be no art without an element of mystery, I think." Unfortunately, the Ruggles were unable to keep the painting. Kent later recalled that he had charged them just $100, but letters during this time contain repeated apologies from Ruggles for not being able to make the payments. Kent eventually reclaimed the work, which in 1918 was sold to Henry Clay Frick for $1,500, and it now resides in the Hirshhorn Museum. Ruggles continued to send Kent regular updates on the opera, which revealed that the two discussed the work's visual setting. In 1915, Ruggles wrote to Kent, who was then in Newfoundland, quote, "I hope I can manage to have you design the scenes, provided you would dare bother with it. But of course, that's all up to Meltzer. Your ideas are wonderfully original and would lend much to the success of the opera." Ruggles moved to New York to work on the Sunken Bell full-time in 1917, leaving Charlotte with their young son Micah here in Winona to earn money. But the opera was never completed, and Ruggles eventually destroyed it. Kent encouraged him to produce work during this time in a manner that shows in vivid contrast the difference between the two men. Kent was unfettered and produced work freely, whereas Ruggles was almost paralyzed by the enormity of the task. He often wrote of how tiring he found the process of composition. Kent wrote to him, "Get to work and make another great opera, Carl. For heaven's sake, begin a new great work. I don't believe you'll ever hear your Sunken Bell for 30 years. You're one of the few great men I've ever met or seen. Do 1,000 things. Pile up those beautiful manuscripts of yours. What if they don't get played? They will, and then you'll laugh and think of the pile of treasures that you have." Carl and Charlotte returned together to New York City in 1918, never to return to Winona. Carl abandoned the opera and began to work on smaller compositions. In 1919, Ruggles wrote a short song entitled Toys for his son's 4th birthday, and Kent provided advice about the title as well as art for the score's cover. The finished product was published in 1920. It was obviously very important to Ruggles that the public know that Kent had designed the cover, and he was concerned that Kent hadn't signed the design. He complained about it, and Kent replied, "What in the world do you think I care so much about a signature for? I'm being continually pestered by owners of my paintings who suddenly discover that the thing is not signed. What magic there is in a signature, I don't know. Anybody that knows anything knows who did a thing, and what if they don't? If you think my name should be on that drawing, put it in type or lettering, and your own lettering will do." This interaction is a really good example of Ruggles' need for others' approval and recognition that he was part of Kent's approval in this process, and also for Kent's lack thereof. Incidentally, the work was published unsigned. I would now like to play a little bit of Ruggles' music, and I do feel the need for a slight disclaimer before I launch into it. Carl Ruggles had a form of composition that he liked to call dissonant counterpoint. He didn't like to repeat notes until he felt he'd used them all up. Usually he went through 11 notes before he would repeat one. And if you can think of songs that make you feel good, Christmas carols, children's songs you've learned, chances are there are quite a few notes that repeat and some notes that just feel really comfortable. You're not going to get that with Ruggles' music. And I debated about playing Toys because I find it very different than his mature style, which I happen to really like a lot. On the other hand, this is the piece that he did coordinate most closely with Kent. So it lasts 1 minute and 34 seconds. And as we listen to it, I would encourage you, I've written the text, I would encourage you to see what Ruggles does with text painting. For instance, what happens when choo-choo cars are used, and at the end, when the balloon floats and floats and floats up to the stars. Scholars believe many of the attributes in this particular work were things he was doing in the destroyed opera. So here is Toys.
I have brought you and ships and trains of choo-choo cars, and the wondrous balloon that floats and
happy 4th birthday, Micah. The two men corresponded about authors that they were reading, and a favorite of Ruggles was Whitman. In words that must have echoed the advice Kent heard from his teacher Robert Henry, Ruggles told Kent, "When you're blue, read Whitman. Yes, read Whitman. He is superb. You have many things in common with Whitman." The two men also corresponded about their work, with Ruggles visiting art galleries in New York to view Kent's most recent work. Their letters during this time reveal the difference in artistic energy that working in isolation engendered. Kent's correspondence is infused with his passion for painting and the energy it brought him, while Ruggles' letters reveal that the act of composing music, especially in isolation, was draining and exhausting. Kent moved to a farm just outside Arlington, Vermont in 1919, and he encouraged Carl and Charlotte to come visit. He even tried to arrange to bring Carl to Vermont as a lecturer for the Arlington Poetry Club, but because Carl had been involved with the socialist Rand School in New York, and there was a misunderstanding about that, he was never invited. Kent finally lured Carl to Arlington with the promise of including a sample of his musical manuscript, as well as an essay about modern music, for an issue of Playboy. And this isn't Hugh Hefner's Playboy, but rather an art and literary magazine that at that point in time was published in Greenwich Village. Although the article never materialized, Ruggles finally visited Kent in Arlington during the fall of 1921. The visit marked an important development in Ruggles' life. He later recalled, quote, "One time, Kent had to go to New York and suggested that while he was away, I try painting a picture and he would compose a piece of music. I made a drawing of Mount Anthony, but when he came back, he hadn't done any music. But he was impressed with my drawing." That drawing of Mount Anthony launched an important second outlet for Ruggles' artistic talent, an outlet in which he was able to shed his inhibitions and the constraints of perfectionism that pervaded his work as a composer. Ruggles became a successful visual artist, mounting shows at the Arts Club of Chicago and the Detroit Institute of Arts, and his paintings are housed in the permanent collections of the Detroit Institute and also the Whitney Museum in New York. All of his correspondence from this time forward is filled with illustration. And you can see it has a real spontaneity that his music just didn't display. Even though Kent didn't compose music, he, Carl, and Charlotte shared many musical moments. He later recalled, "The three of us, Carl at the piano, Charlotte as a contralto, and I on my flute, had many pleasant musical evenings together, Carl composing flute obligatos for the German leader that we performed." During this time, Kent designed the cover for a symphonic suite that Ruggles had entitled Men and Angels. And this time, it was signed. Ruggles felt that the design captured the, quote, transcendental essence implicit in his music. Unfortunately, the work was never completed in this form, so the cover illustration was never used for publication. The first movement, Angels, was rewritten as a hymn for six muted trumpets, And another movement was transformed into the first movement of Ruggles' orchestral work, Men and Mountains. I'd like to have you listen to just a snippet of each of these compositions, because this is really Ruggles' music in the mature form. This is Angels, his hymn for six muted trumpets, and if you like Miles Davis at all, you could put that hat on as you listen to this. I always kind of channel Miles in his cool blue period with this, but anyway. That's that. And then Men, from Men and Mountains. This is really Ruggles' mature orchestral sound. He takes all of those non-repeated notes and stacks them up on top of each other in a very dramatic way. So this is a little bit of his Men. That was Men. The fact that Ruggles chose the title Men and Mountains reveals another interesting tie to Kent, who suggested it, and had used the same title both for a painting dating from 1909 and for a publicized account of his European travels following the passport denial. The works were inspired by the Blake quote, "Great things are done when men and mountains meet." This is not done by jostling in the street. Kent's painting depicts nude men wrestling at the base of mountains and caused such a scandal when it was exhibited in Columbus, Ohio, that in 1910 that it was placed in a separate room marked Men Only. Carl and Charlotte moved back to New York in 1922, and it was a period that became Carl's most productive as a composer. He became increasingly involved with the contemporary music scene, and with Edgar Varèse became a founding member of the group of ultramodern composers known as the International Composers Guild. The group provided not only an outlet for his performance, but also a schedule that demanded that Ruggles produce on a regular basis. That spring, Ruggles also gave three lectures at the Whitney Studio Club, and it had been Kent who had introduced his dear friend, Carl Ruggles, to the influential Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney. The Ruggles spent the summer of 1923 in Arlington with Kent's friend, Dorothy Canfield Fisher, and they liked the area well enough to want to settle there permanently. And in a move that mirrors Kent's first residence in Winona, they purchased an old schoolhouse that they made into a warm and welcoming home. Ironically, even though Ruggles had settled in Kent's hometown, the two saw less of each other after that time. Kent's marriage to Kathleen ended in divorce in 1925. He married Frances Lee in 1926, traveled extensively, and eventually settled in upstate New York. Neither man was on sound financial footing, and correspondence reveals their attempts to help one another find gainful employment. Ruggles encouraged his most prominent student in New York, Mrs. Joseph Grace of the Grace Shipping Line, to consider purchasing a painting of Kent's. He wrote, Has the North Wind been sold? I ask because yesterday I gave Mrs. Grace her first lesson, and during the session I illustrated some point with toys. She immediately was struck by the title page, thought it extremely beautiful, all of which gave me a fine opportunity to launch forth on your behalf. I told her about the North Wind, and I'm sure I can manage to take her to see it, perhaps after her lesson. And what about Bear Glacier? Is that still at Nolder's? To which Kent responded, I need to sell a picture. Sell it for us. Less than a year later, it was Kent who interceded with Mrs. Grace, who had terminated her lessons with Carl, and Kent worried it was because he had moved to Arlington. He went to see her in her rose garden and relayed the following information to Carl. Here's what's settled with Mrs. Grace. I called her up immediately on my arrival in the city and was asked out for dinner the night of the next day. I had a talk with Dr. Bartlett before I went and, fully armed, launched an overpowering gas attack. But by God, it had to be overwhelming to get by with her. She is hard. However, you get $100 a month for 6 months. You're to live with me in Arlington and Charlotte to settle where she can get students. You're to give Mrs. G 2 lessons a month and are to be paid your round trip fare each time to Arlington. If things go well, this is likely to be continued. Kent also introduced Ruggles to several other important benefactors, including Harriet Bingham, to whom his orchestral work Portals was dedicated. And Kent did not a title page, but just at the top of the first page a musical manuscript, an illustration. And Ruggles was to rely on the support of wealthy donors for the rest of his life. In addition to his painting and travels, Kent worked as an illustrator for both the socialist periodical The Masses and Vanity Fair, and obviously did numerous book illustrations. These jobs obviously paid the bills, but they also provided Kent with a subtle vehicle for his message. As an author and artist, Kent employed the pseudonym Hogarth Jr. in Vanity Fair and used Ruggles as a model for one of 4 caricatures, which he entitled Tragedies of the Self and Anti-Self. Hogarth Jr. shows the conflict between what the neighbors see and what Dr. Freud would guess. He presented Ruggles as the great of soul and characterized him thusly. How often we see great genius encased in narrow physical accommodations. The sample below is one of those. The field of his art is that of the universal. He, according to his story, is man dominating the cosmic all. As if to symbolize his ambitions, his clothes, hat, cigar, etc. are all too big for him. So are his ideas. Perhaps he will grow into them someday. Correspondence between Ruggles and Kent dwindled in the 1930s, but they continued to remember one another and followed each other's careers. Kent attended the premiere of Ruggles' Men in Mountains and in New York, and although not present, received a detailed description from his daughter of the premiere of Ruggles' masterpiece, The Sun Treader, in 1966. Both men were honored by Bowdoin College in the 1960s. Bowdoin had a 2-day festival in Ruggles' honor in 1966, and an exhibition entitled Rockwell Kent, the Early Years was mounted at Bowdoin in 1969. And both men died in the same year, 1971. That each man had an influence upon each other and his creative process is without question. As lovers of German culture, they paid the highest compliments to one another, Kent comparing Ruggles to Beethoven, and Ruggles in turn comparing Kent to Wagner. They helped each other find ways to survive, being first and foremost artists during an especially difficult economic time in the United States. In 1926, Kent wrote to Ruggles from Ireland, confessing that among all the men I have ever known, you're the only one who has contributed to me anything of value in art. Yours is the only intelligence or spirit that has impressed me. Had the two men met one another in the East, their impact on one another might not have been so profound. Meeting instead in this Minnesota town in 1913 provided a bond that seemingly endured throughout their lifetimes. as men of both great similarities and great differences. The convergence of these two lives in Winona, Minnesota, be it considered a must-stop for the theatrical world, a forward-looking educational center, or exile. There's no doubt that both men began a bond formed by a sort of expatriate experience here in Winona, an experience that did, that does, and that will continue to enrich us all.
Thank you again to Beth Christensen for her talk on Rockwell Kent and Carl Ruggles. We would also like to thank the people that made Beth's presentation possible: Taft Roberts, the English Department at Winona State University, the Minnesota Marine Art Museum, through Ernest and Sally Mysek family, in memory of W.B. Gausch. Thank you all for making the Rockwell Kent Centennial Celebration a success. You've been listening to Art Beat.
Art Beat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.